We're studying from Mark 11 this evening. If you turn over to Mark 11, titled this lesson, Nothing But Leaves. We're talking about the time that Jesus curses a fig tree. And this is an interesting account, one that gets misunderstood very easily, especially when taken in isolation. But the way that Mark tells it helps us understand what Jesus is doing here and that this has always been about more than a fig tree, that Jesus was concerned with something a lot bigger. Let's read Mark 11, verses 12 through 14. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing him a distance, a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. Jesus was traveling with his disciples as they are on the road. He is hungry and looking for something that he could eat. It was pretty common practice in those days that as you're traveling through, if there's a fruit tree or some stalks of grain, that it was considered polite on the part of the owners to allow people to take, you know, small amounts of what they were eating, just enough of what they could eat in that moment. Or possibly this fig tree is even a wild one and not belonging to anybody in particular. But regardless, Jesus up ahead sees a tree that you would expect to have fruit on it. This is taking place in the early spring. A lot of the trees and plants have not started producing yet. And so a fig tree is going to stand out. While most branches are bare, this one is going to be lush with leaves. It was not yet the season for figs, what we are told in verse 13, which is a strange remark to make as Jesus is looking for figs on this tree. We'll talk some more about what that means. But as Jesus approaches this tree, he looks to see if there's anything on it. There's nothing but leaves, and he curses it, saying, "May it never produce fruit again for anybody to eat." Now, I have heard multiple times over the years people use this occasion to try to describe Jesus as an impulsive, out-of-control person who got so angry over seeing a tree that had the audacity not to have fruit for him that he zapped it into the ground just because he couldn't control his emotions that way. And then you add in the extra remark that it's not the season for figs yet, and you go, well, what did he expect? It's too early for figs. You're not going to see anything there. Why would you go to a tree before it was time and expect to see anything at all? Well, it is difficult to understand why Jesus is doing this if we don't have slightly more context. I'll show you a picture here. This is a picture of a branch of a similar type of fig tree that you would see there. And you can see in the background here the leaves that are all on this tree. And these little knobs here, those are not figs, actually. Those are what they call taksh, I believe. I'm not sure if that's how you say that or not. I'm definitely not a Hebrew or a Greek scholar, either way. But these are the precursors to figs that you would find on these trees. So the way that this worked was you had a barren tree, nothing on it yet. First, in the early spring, earlier than other plants, the leaves would begin to come on it. Then you would have these little knobs, these little fruits that are sometimes described as looking like little green almonds. They don't really get any bigger than this here. This is all that they are. And they are not worth harvesting. They are not worth, like, really deliberately looking to get and to eat. They're not that good at eating. And in fact, after a little while, they're all going to fall off and be replaced by actual figs. And it's the figs that you really want. That's what you would plant a fig tree for. That's what you would typically want to harvest. But if you were in dire straits, or if you're passing by and they've got these little knobs on them, you can eat them. They are edible, and they will, you know, satiate your hunger, at least there in that moment. So what Jesus is looking for on this tree is not necessarily a fig, because once again, it is not the season for figs, but he's looking for this little touch. Now, why is this significant? Not just because Jesus is looking for something to eat, but because with these trees, if a fig tree is not producing these, it will not grow figs. If all you have is a branch with just leaves on it, it will go through the whole season with nothing but leaves until they drop off. And so you actually get a sign ahead of time whether it will produce anything of use or not. So when Jesus looks at this tree, and all over it is just leaves, not a single one of these anywhere, he knows two things. This is not of use to him now, and it's not of use to anyone later. It's not going to produce anything. And that is not a good place for a fruit-bearing tree to be in. That's why these fruit-bearing trees are planted. That's what they're for. And so Jesus curses the tree. Even though it looks like it has the appearance of something useful, he curses it so that it will never produce anything good again. Still, though, we ask, why does Jesus care? Surely there is another tree. Surely he can hold his hunger. If Jesus could make it 40 days out in the wilderness fasting, surely he could make it to the next town when they can find something to eat. Or down the road a little bit until they find another fig tree. Why curse this one? Why have such a strong reaction to it? This is not about a fig tree. This is not about a plant. This is about Jerusalem. This is about the Jews. In verses 15 through 19, this account in Mark's retelling is broken up a little bit. We're going to come back to the fig tree after they get out of Jerusalem and they see the fig tree again. They'll see that Jesus' curse has come true. The fig tree is withered. But in between, Mark tells us a story that seems unrelated. It is not unrelated. It is the point of the story. It is the fig tree. And it helps us see what Jesus' attitude toward Jerusalem is. Mark 11, verses 15 through 19. And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple, and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them and saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations'? But you have made it a den of robbers." And the chief priests and the scribes heard it and were seeking a way to destroy him, for they feared him, because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out of the city. After cursing the tree, Jesus goes on up into Jerusalem, and he makes his way to the temple, enters that outer court where the Gentiles could be, where they were allowed to worship God if they so chose, and where a lot of business was taking place. And Jesus starts driving people out. This is the second occasion where Jesus is purging the temple, cleansing the temple in some way. He sees all these people who are buying and selling goods, and he starts chasing them out of the temple court. He sees tables set up with money changers, and seats of these women who are selling pigeons to be used in sacrifices, and again, overturns them, disrupts everything that is happening there, and starts driving people out. What's going on? Why are all these people here in the temple court? There's a few things that are happening. All of these things that we have listed here are in support of the sacrifices and offerings that took place at the temple. This is where people came to buy the animals that they needed to sacrifice. So generally, you remember in the law, they're supposed to take an animal from their flocks, from their herds. They were supposed to choose it a certain way and go and to deliver that as a sacrifice to the Lord. But you know, not everybody has flocks and herds. People serve different roles in society. Even back then, not everybody had those things for themselves. Yet they are still supposed to give those offerings. Well, if you serve some different role in society, you have some different kind of job, you might not have the animals, but you have money. You can go and buy those animals and use them as sacrifices. And that's exactly what was happening here. Or maybe they're traveling a long way, and they're not necessarily going to bring that animal all the way with them. They can go to one of these vendors, buy the calf or the goat or whatever it is that they need to offer up to the Lord, and it's all very convenient. It's right there in the temple courtyard. You go, take it to the priest, offer it as your sacrifice, and that can work. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. There were also, you know, the women there on their seats that were selling pigeons. There were some of the sacrifices involved some smaller birds that they could sacrifice. And this was often a measure for the poorer people in society who did not have the more valuable animals or the money to buy them. They were given a provision to offer something less, to offer these pigeons or something like that. And so you have those for sale as well. There was also a half shekel offering that every Israelite was supposed to make. And it had to be exactly half a shekel. You couldn't offer more or less for this particular sacrifice, for this particular, levy that is assessed. And so if you are coming into Jerusalem and you have one of many different currencies, you need to turn that into a half shekel. That's what these money changers are for. It's like what you see in airports these days, right? You've come into a new country. You've got a bunch of euros. How many stores around here take euros? Not that many. So you get U.S. dollars. And, of course, as money changers take some kind of fee for providing the service, but you can get money that is useful and make change even and have the denominations that you need. They have that sort of thing as well. There were different currencies for different places, and they needed to have the exact half shekel coin that they could use to make that offering. So all of these things are there in the outer court to support what was going on. And then we have added on top of that, we're told that Jesus starts chasing people out of the temple court who were passing through. In verse 16, he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. What's that about? Well, if you look at a map of Jerusalem, the temple complex is large. And it kind of got in the way of some of the other things that you needed to do. Depending on where you were going and where you were coming from, oftentimes you had to make a long trip around the whole temple complex just to get where you were going. You can't just cut through, right? And especially if you are a servant or a laborer or somebody who's carrying a heavy load, going way out of your way to go all the way around the temple is not ideal. So the priests started letting people cut through, particularly if you have these loads. You say, if you're a servant, you're a laborer, you're doing something that is important, just come through a temple courtyard and take the most direct path possible. And Jesus puts a stop to this. He says, don't cut through. Go around. Now, there is obviously some critique of their behavior here. It is somewhat debatable to what degree Jesus is critiquing it. You know, was it a problem for there to have any amount of this commerce here? It's hard to know. To some extent, though, at least, Jesus does not approve of the level of commerce that is taking place in this temple court. And there seems to be some implication that it would be better for this to happen outside of the temple complex and not within it. It seems to be implied that they should not be cutting through so casually, but should be remaining outside or going around when they have their loads. Because even though this outer court is not the most holy place, it is not where the priests are making their most important sacrifices, it is still part of the temple, and it should not be treated quite so commonly. However, Jesus' main purpose is not to reform their behavior. There's a certain level of reform and critique happening here, but if his only purpose is to get them to use the temple better, he's not really done that in a very effective way. He's not addressed it with the people in charge who are allowing all of these things to happen. Think about that. You have a laborer who's coming through with a heavy load, and Jesus says, don't go through here, go around. That's fine. What about all of the other people later that day and tomorrow and the next day who are going to cut through because they've been told by the people in charge that they can do that? Jesus has not gone and talked to the priests about it. He's not addressed the people in charge. He has disrupted the commerce that's happened there, and it's more than just shady business practices because he's driven out the buyers and the sellers. So it's not just that sellers are taking advantage of people. He's critiqued the whole concept of the level of commerce there. But again, do any of us believe that this actually put an end to any of it? Or when Jesus left, did the money changers pick up their tables and get their displays set back up again? And the buyers and sellers come back in and resume like nothing had happened, maybe with a story to tell when they went home, for sure, but not much more than, wow, that Jesus guy sure made a scene in the temple today. Wonder what that was all about. When you compare this especially to some other cases in the Bible of cleansing the temple, what Jesus is doing is not as effective as what some of those others did. So King Josiah and the high priest Hilkiah, for example, in 2 Kings 23, we won't go and read it, but they go through and do this very comprehensive cleansing of everything that is wrong, taking that out of the temple and restoring it to exactly the way that it should be. They remove all the idols, all the unclean things. They set everything in order and get the temple worship back in its proper place. So are we saying here that Jesus is a worse version of King Josiah, a worse version of the high priest Hilkiah, that he's only doing some ineffective version of their temple cleansing? I don't believe so. There's something more happening here. This is more intended to be a spectacle and intended to make a point that reform is not what Jesus is after. In fact, he's issuing a judgment against them. We'll prove that some more as we go on. So hold that idea in your head. If you're not yet convinced about it, we'll develop it some more. But I want to address another phrase first. We're told that Jesus said, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." Now, this is sometimes used, this is quoting two different passages, one from Isaiah 56, that's the first half of it, and secondly from Jeremiah 7, about the den of robbers. And this is sometimes used to say, look, there's all this robbery happening in the temple court. It's the den of robbers as the sellers are taking advantage of people, and they have a bad and dishonest form of commerce. But it's a little bit different than that. If you go back to those passages, you see that there's a different emphasis. First being that God's plan was to gather all nations to himself. Isaiah 56, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations." This outer court was where the Gentiles were allowed to worship God if they wanted. And this is, to some degree, disrupted by the commerce that is happening there. They're turning this into a marketplace. And so it's not a very effective house of prayer for the Gentiles, but the Jews don't really care about that because it doesn't matter what the Gentiles are doing. The Gentiles are scum anyway who could never be right with God, who could never be worshiping alongside of us, so they don't care about that. But then secondly, in Jeremiah 7, about the den of robbers, The robbers here are more likely bandits. And the focus with a den of bandits or even a den of robbers is not what is happening in the den. It's what's happening outside. This is like the bandits that were out on the highways in those days. Remember like the parable of the Good Samaritan? that you had a Jewish man who's walking down the road. He's traveling from one city to another, and he's waylaid by robbers, by bandits, who are there to steal everything that he has, and they beat him within an inch of his life, and they run away. Well, where do they run to? They run to a hideout. They run to a safe place that they have, somewhere out there in the wilderness that's their den. The den of robbers, the den of bandits, is the safe place that the evildoers go to store their riches, to store their spoils, and to be protected from those who might go and be chasing after them. What Jesus is saying here is that the temple has become that kind of hideout for the Jews. Go to Jeremiah 7, verses 8 through 15. We're going to read this, and hopefully that will convince you that this analysis is correct. Jeremiah 7, 8 through 15. "Behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known? And then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, 'We are delivered,' only to go on doing all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I myself have seen it, declares the Lord. Go now to my place that was in Shiloh, where I made my name dwell at first, and see what I did to it because of the evil of my people Israel. And now, because you have done all these things, declares the Lord, and when I spoke to you persistently, you did not listen, and when I called you, you did not answer. Therefore, I will do to the house that is called by my name, and in which you trust, and to the place that I gave to you and to your fathers, as I did to Shiloh. And I will cast you out of my sight, as I cast out all your kinsmen, all the offspring of Ephraim." So, in Jeremiah's day, the people of Judah were out stealing, murdering, committing adultery, swearing falsely, worshiping idols, and then they come to the house of the Lord as their safe place, as their hideout, as their abode of holiness, to say, look how safe we are because Yahweh is our God. The focus in Jeremiah 7 is not like the focus in Malachi. In Malachi, they get beat up a bit by God because they have been worshiping improperly and sacrificing improperly. And there's a big focus on the improper worship that's happening within the temple. Jeremiah does address that some. There is some critique of what's going on in the temple. But the bigger problem in Jeremiah's day wasn't that they weren't offering the right offerings. They were. It wasn't that they weren't worshiping God. They were. It wasn't that they had forgotten about the temple. They were still going. It's that they thought they could go sin in a myriad ways and then go to the temple and say, God, we are your people. Isn't it so wonderful that you are our God? It was the den of bandits. It was their safe place to come and to revel in their own holiness. And God said, this temple is not as safe as you think it is. Because you are going and sending in all these ways, I am not afraid to destroy my temple. It bears my name, and I don't care. It's going to crumble. It's going to be destroyed. And it will not protect you from the Babylonians who are coming to judge you. Remember what I did in Shiloh, that I brought a judgment there against you, and that the Ark of the Covenant was not safe from capture just because you brought it into battle. So, in Jesus' day, when he says, my temple has become a den of robbers, what is he saying? He's alluding back to these days of Jeremiah and saying what was true then is true now. There are some problems, sure, with your worship. We know that. We know that they had some things wrong with the way they were worshiping God. But bigger than that was that they were committing all kinds of evil outside of the temple and then coming back into it and believing that their status as the people of God gave them some kind of safety. Doesn't that make sense with what the Pharisees said? We are God's children. We are God's people. We have never been enslaved to anybody, which is like demonstrably not true. But regardless, they believed there was this special status that protected them from any kind of judgment from God. Jesus is not happy with what's going on in Jerusalem. He's not happy with what's going on among the Jews. And now we come back to the fig tree. And now we learn a lesson from what Jesus is doing with this tree that is of no consequence in any ordinary time. Read Mark 11, verses 20 through 25 with me. Mark 11, 20 through 25. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered. And Jesus answered them, Have faith in God. Truly I say to you, that whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes what he will say will come to pass, it will be done for him. Therefore I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. And whenever you stand praying, forgive, and if you have done anything against anyone, so that your Father also, who is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses. As they left Jerusalem, and by the way, as they left Jerusalem, there were a bunch of people mad at them, which should not be a surprise. They've caused a scene in the court of the temple, and the chief priests are not happy about it. A lot of the religious people are not happy about it. And this is an escalation of the kind of anger they have against Jesus that led to them seeking to crucify him in the times to come. But as they're leaving Jerusalem, having made this statement, they pass by the fig tree again. And Peter says, look, it's withered. All the way from top to bottom, all the way from the tip of the branches to the roots in the ground, all withered and gone. And Jesus responds, have faith in God and forgive others that God may forgive you. Brethren, Jerusalem is the fig tree. Judaism is the fig tree. There is no reformation of Jerusalem happening. Jesus did not come to Israel to reform the covenant that they were under. He did not come to reform their behavior and their worship. He's saying they're past reform. They've gone too far. It's time for judgment. Of course, what gets overshadowed by that time for judgment, and we see a judgment against them, AD 70, Jerusalem gets destroyed again, the temple's destroyed again. It's Babylon all over again. It's just by the name of Rome this time. But what gets overshadowed by that is Jesus came not just as Jeremiah to say, the end is here, you're going to be destroyed. Jesus came to say, this Jewish system is going to be fulfilled and then tossed aside and destroyed. It's now no longer of use. He's saying, I'm replacing it with something that is better. I'm fulfilling it and establishing my kingdom, my church, to the fullest fulfillment of what was said in Isaiah. My house shall be a prayer, shall be a house of prayer for all the nations. The temple only kind of fulfilled that. You know what fulfills that today? The church. There are people all over the world who are worshiping God, who are praying to God. We are joined today as we have worshiped, as we have been praying and appealing to God and studying His Word, by people all over the world who are doing the very same thing. When I was in Florida a few weeks ago, I met a couple of preachers, one from India, one from Italy, both who have done a lot of work over there and were able to talk some about what the church looks like in India and what the church looks like in Italy. I've never been to India or Italy. I don't know anybody over there, but I have brothers and sisters over there who are worshiping God, who are appealing to the same Savior who died to save me from my sins. The kingdom of God is not just reformed Judaism. And we have a couple of things to remember and applications for this, application of this for us. First being that Christ is able to identify leaves versus fruit. He could do it with Jerusalem. He could do it with Judaism and what the Jews were doing. Do you think he can't do it now? Do you think he can't look at your life, at this congregation, at his people, and identify whether we only have the outward sign of production or whether we are really producing something? Jesus is very patient with us as we grow, as we are progressing from these, you know, the little talks there of something that's only a little useful until we are producing figs in the future. But if you don't even have these, if you're not starting to produce anything, if you're not making any kind of progress and effort, then why shouldn't Jesus curse you and run out of patience for you because you're not making an effort to seek him? Christ is patient, not blind. He knows the difference. The anger of God is hot against those who rebel against him and who refuse to submit. And so we give you an invitation today to consider the state of your soul. What kind of tree are you? Remember that Christ has established a kingdom that you can be a citizen of, that if you're not a Christian, you can become one. You can have your sins washed away in baptism. You can declare him as your Lord, but you believe in Jesus Christ. You can turn away from all of your sins. You can commit yourself to following Jesus forever and begin that process of producing fruit. We'd love to see you do that and to have you join us in that. And if you, as a Christian, realize that there are nothing but leaves in your life, no fruit, not enough fruit, and you want to change that, you still have time to do so, because Jesus's curse has not come yet. The withering has not come yet. But one day it will. Judgment is coming. Are you ready? Let's sing number 279 together, and if there's something we can do for you, come as we stand and sing.